Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next guest is an activist. He's a social justice guy. He tells me he's got the looks for radio, so I'll let you guys decide that once you've listened to the interview. How odd and absurd is that? We talk about human rights and policy inconsistencies. We talk about the politicization of a young girl's human rights. And we talk about this thing called statelessness. And Vaden is a guy who has a story. He has many stories to tell, actually. He's an author. He's a public speaker. He's a motivator. And he wants to talk about things that matter. And we're also going to hear about a very personal story that you're going to want to stay tuned for and find out more information about online. You can read more there in the bio. You can listen into the interview, and I know that you are going to be engaged. We talk about humanizing the statistic and what it means to be politically correct. Haiti comes up, oppression comes up, global poverty, the majority world. Stay tuned for a little bit more coming right up on Face to Face with Vaden Earle. And don't forget facetofacelive.ca for more of my own podcasting, davidpecklive.com for a bit of info about my writing and public speaking, and rabble.ca as well for more information about some other podcasting and blogging and so on, and a website about everything that matters. And you can also support the work that I'm doing through Face to Face on patreon.com if you feel so inclined. Coming right up, Vaden Earle here today on Face to Face. Well, welcome to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today. Jess, yes, believe it or not, another very special guest. That's the only kind we have here on Face to Face. Vaden Earle is with us today all the way from the DR. He is live and in person. Vaden, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dave.
So we've been trying to make this happen for what, about 17 years, I think, this podcast?
Approximately, yeah. 16 and a half, I think, is the exact one.
We predated podcasting, actually, this interview, or at least the desire for it.
Yep, you got it.
So, Vaden, you've got a really interesting biography. Author, activist, social justice, social change guy. You're connected to volunteerism. You've traveled the world, youth leadership. The list is pretty endless. If somebody cornered you and said, tell me a bit about Vaden Earle, what would you say?
Boy, I try and walk away, but I think for my whole life, ever since as young as I can remember, the theme, if I could sum it up into one thing, is I always like to fight for the underdog. So that puts me in a spot where I do push for social justice, and I have become quite a human rights activist. And my travels around the world mostly have been to the developing world, the majority world, where things aren't the way we're used to seeing them in Canada or the U.S.
What do you mean? I mean, it's an interesting way of looking at it. Majority world. I've heard global South, two thirds world. Can you unpack that a little bit for the listeners?
Yeah, it's, you know, in the world of being politically correct, we never know what to call anything anymore without offending somebody. But I like to use the term majority world because it invokes the thought that we are the exception with our affluence that we have in Canada and the U.S. We're not the rule. We're the exception. And the majority of the world does live on less than $2 a day. So when I say I've traveled to the majority world, those are the places that are trying to get a step up and get on that ladder to recovery, get out of poverty. And I don't like using third world as much just because it conjures up a different kind of mentality. I like to put the onus back on us to say we're not the rule. We are the exception.
So in 2007, you published, I think it was 2007, you published a beautiful book, a tragically beautiful book. Is that a fair phrase?
I like that phrase, and thank you for the compliment.
Yeah. One, a face behind the numbers. Tell us a bit about it. It was based on what no longer, I think, exists. The Millennium Development Goals been replaced by the Sustainable Development Goals. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of the book, where it took you. I mean, just beautiful, beautiful photography, so well written, and such a affirming challenge to us all.
Yeah, the book, it was an outflow of what was going on in my head for about a couple of years before that. I had traveled to some pretty dark corners of Thailand and Cambodia, as I know you have as well. And I remember even in some places throughout the Caribbean that you'd expect to see on a postcard, not on a, you know, a UN chart. And I saw some things that blew my mind. And I came home and I did some research, and all I started to see was all these giant numbers. 30,000 people a day die in Africa. And it's not even a tragedy. It's just a number at that point.
Right.
I mean, it's like 30,000 people died today in Africa. Somebody passed the beer nuts sort of thing, right? It just you fold that into a conversation as if it meant nothing. And it bothered me so much because I met a handful of those 30,000 people in Africa or in Thailand or in Cambodia, wherever I've been. So I started to think there's got to be a way of humanizing some of these statistics, because when they're just numbers, it's very difficult for me to get passionate about them. So I started collecting stories when I traveled, and as well as collecting photography. And I realized that 30,000 people dying a day is a number. But if I hear the name of that one child that struggled because he only got to eat once a week, and how he fought through it and ended up passing away, if I know his name and I see a picture of his face, that now is a tragedy. That can break my heart. Whereas a number just wasn't doing it.
So your role was to sort of connect, and I don't really like the language, but, you know, over here and over there, bridging the gap, finding a way to speak about these issues in a way that actually mattered. This wasn't about quantification anymore. This wasn't about numbers and math and stats. This is, you got to go deeper.
Yeah, it was about humanizing it, really. I mean, if I could boil it down to a phrase, that book, the entire purpose of that book was about humanizing the global tragedy that is extreme poverty.
Where do you sit today? So 10 years old, I'm kind of blown away that the book's been out for 10 years. I think you've mentioned before possibly writing a follow-up. Maybe you're working on a project like that currently, but you know, if you read the stats, numbers apparently are going down of children that die every day, and you know, it would appear on a certain level things are getting better. What's your sense?
Well, I don't know if I'm ready to jump on to the getting better bandwagon, but I'm ready to say it's changing. I don't know if it's all for the better. You know, less people are dying of hunger and more are dying of malaria, for example. So there's still a lot to be done. And yeah, we have made grounds. You talk with folks like Jeffrey Sachs, for example. More countries, to use his terminology, are getting on the ladder to get out of poverty. But certainly the task is daunting. I live as you said earlier, here in Dominican Republic, and we're snuggled up on the same island with Haiti. And it only takes a 2-hour drive to get into a place where, you know, you can't even fathom the abject poverty that we see in Port-au-Prince. And we're talking about 7 years after that giant earthquake, and there's still 750,000 people living in tents from that. Mm-hmm. So I know there's a lot of people that are very positive about where we're going, but we're scratching the surface, certainly.
How do you, Vaden, you know, it's something that continues to be a challenge, you know, here in Canada. One of our, there was just an announcement recently about, you know, sort of the feminization of foreign aid and where that's going to take us. It's about gender equality and decreasing that gap. And yet our Canadian government didn't really at this point, and I'm hopeful, but at this point didn't really put a whole lot more money towards, you know, our overseas development assistance and so on. And it's got to be about more than money. It seems to me it's about justice and it's about human rights and it's about all of these things. How do you think, you know, how do you get people to care about this in a way that isn't guilt ridden, that appeals, I don't know, to people's overarching sense of humanity? I mean, most of us lead incredibly busy lives. We have our families, we've got our own issues and work and so on, and our creative projects. How the heck do you get under that surface?
Well, it's a tough conversation to have, and it's actually a very sensitive one when you speak to folks within North America, or we'll call it the West, the global West, if we can call it that. Because the minute you start talking about changing the way things are done, or maybe improving the lives of those in the majority world, you start to talk about, well, maybe that's going to get me out of my comfort zone. Like you said, we're all busy. We all have to-do lists and agendas and day planners and smartphones and all this stuff. So we have things we got to get to. And when someone says, well, hey, you want me to donate my money or my time or my emotional energy into something? Well, we don't have a lot of that left over at the end of the day. So it becomes a conversation that not everyone's super comfortable with, just because it does infringe on our way of life. My trouble with that is very simple. And this gets into a place not a lot of people want to go with me, but I don't believe that our way of life as it exists could have existed or can exist without the oppression of some of these countries that we're talking about. Hmm. So with that comes a responsibility. We have all the affluence you can imagine. I believe with that comes a responsibility to do something for our fellow man. And it might be the soup kitchen downtown in a metropolis in North America, but it also has to be in a place that they've never had an opportunity to get out of that poverty trap.
So, I mean, when you look at it that way, and I've never really thought of it, I don't think I've thought of it quite this way before, but it's almost like this is a kind gesture back to the folks that we exploited, back to the places that we took advantage of in order to get where we are today. I mean, you and I, of course, directly had nothing to do with it. But when you look back, you go back into our bloodlines and our histories and so on, we're probably not that far removed some pretty horrific stuff.
Yeah, and it's everyone's having the same conversation about how long do we pay for what our ancestors did.
Right.
And that conversation happens with Aboriginal issues. It happens with, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and all the different things that are current. But there's a difference that I'd like to draw. And again, certainly not to get into any of those conversations, but right now, most of the conversations we have about that are about past atrocities that have stopped, and the people talking have not been involved either as perpetrators or victims, for the most part. Not always, but for the most part, we're talking about things that are done. When it comes to global poverty, this isn't over. Today, 30,000 more people, or close to that, will die. And I think that's the difference, is that we're living currently in a level of affluence that still probably would not exist if it were not for the current level of decimation, if you will, of the economics of the third world or the majority world, like I said.
So is, I mean, it's, you're Canadian, right?
I am Canadian, yes.
Yeah, so
yes,
I mean,
I wouldn't think it. I haven't been living in Canada for a long time, but my passport says Canada.
So pretty interesting with the 150th, birthday party recently, 150th anniversary, whatever you want to call it. We've got, Canada spending a whole lot of money on celebrations, on, honoring who we are. We've got Bono and the Edge coming to Parliament Hill. That was an interesting slip to Parliament Hill to sing one and to talk about opportunity and to talk about, how Canada sets trends and we don't follow them. All wonderful stuff. And yet a pretty dark history in some regards and in many, many regards. And so many people saying, hang on a minute here, you're going to spend all this money celebrating something that really is leaving out a big part of the story.
Yeah, and I understand there's something to be said for let's have a jumping off point and have a positive outlook from this point forward. I get it, but to ignore history is a bit silly. And the other thing, if you're going to, this might be my own little beef, but if you're going to ignore the past in the celebrations, at least spend the exorbitant amounts of money on something other than rubber ducks and big red bouncy balls and stuff like that. Like that, to me, it was a double whammy. It was a slap in the face to pretend our history is so great. But it's a bigger slap when the celebrations are just on silly things that just mean nothing to anybody, including Canadians. I mean, I don't know of anybody that was like, woohoo, a rubber bouncy ball in Calgary. I don't know that person.
I don't know about the rubber bouncy balls in Calgary. What did I miss there, Vin?
There was a giant red rubber bouncy ball in Calgary, and I can't remember how much it cost, but it was it would have put every homeless person in a shelter, that's for sure. Safely.
Right. Yeah, it's a difficult conversation, and I, as you know, I teach at Humber College, and just a couple of weeks ago this year, we had Kairos come in. We were blessed to have them come, and we had a Bob Phillips, First Nations elder, come and run a blanket ceremony for us, and we've done this the last couple of years, and then we followed it up with a lunch made by a local Syrian woman who's a newcomer to Canada. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that in some respects. But you know, here we had 60 students doing this blanket ceremony. You got to do one if you ever get an opportunity. But talk about taking you back. Talk about rooting you in a history that says, yeah, you know what? We got to move forward. Absolutely got to step, but we got to look back to sort of start to break down, some of those connecting dots. What does reconciliation actually mean, and how are we going to move forward? And whether you like Trudeau or not, and that's not a comment to you or to anyone else, really, but just it seems like having emerged after 40-minute conversation out of the teepee on Parliament Hill, that he's open to conversation. Where it's going to head is another story.
Yeah, let's hope so. I mean, who knows? I just see so much political posturing going on these days that I believe things when the rubber hits the road, that's for sure. When it's in theory mode, I'm skeptical. I got to see something practical happen, but hopefully you're correct in that.
Yeah, the large rubber ball was hitting the road in Calgary, apparently.
Yeah, the big red rubber ball. And then I didn't get to see the rubber ducky. I'm not sure if you were honored enough to get a selfie with it or not, but I did not.
I did not. I mean, I'm very tempted here, but it'll take me away from our conversation to do a quick bit of research on the big red rubber ball. That's pretty funny.
Something else.
So here's a quote. Where are you from? What is your nationality? These are pretty common questions. Imagine not being able to give a straight answer. Imagine a life where no country will claim you as its own. This is a situation called statelessness, close quote. Do you know who that is?
I'm not sure, but it sounds like an uber intelligent, very good looking human being.
So that's chapter 7, man. That's page 145 of your book, One Face Behind the Numbers.
I recognize it.
I bet you do. I want to talk about what's going on in your life. You've got a personal story to share, I would say more than a personal beef, but talk to me a little bit about statelessness and let's connect it to what's going on in your family's life.
Well, as I said earlier, when I started writing that book, it was all about humanizing the statistics, and one that was glaring at me was this thing called statelessness, because it's not a term that a lot of people know.
No.
And the reality is, a disproportionately low number of children around the world, when they're born, don't get a birth certificate. And people in our world, it's a given. It's just a given. It's just what happens. And we don't consider that a potential global pandemic because it just happens for us. It's automatic. And if it doesn't happen, someone's going to get fined or go to jail because it's an inalienable right that has to be granted to everyone that's born. But I don't know the exact current numbers, but I believe we're getting close to 12 million people right now that we know of that are stateless in the world. And the problem with a issue like statelessness is we don't know. So we could say 12, it could be 200 million. We don't know by virtue of the fact that they're stateless. So it's hard to count those that we don't recognize as humans, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. So root that a little bit more in some common experience, because I know you've got plenty of it. What does that mean to me? I don't have a birth certificate. I'm living in a country. I mean, obviously, emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, I get it. But are we talking about things like access to healthcare as sort of fundamental as that? Or is this even bigger?
Well, it starts immediately because you can't, in most countries, you can't even get access to education without some sort of a passport or birth certificate or whatever country, whatever official document that country issues. So you start with education. So now you've got children that can't even get a primary education. So now they go down a path. If that's juncture number one is education, go left to education, go right to no education. They go right. So they go right. Now they're going down a road where what are they doing during the day when all the other kids are in school? So there's other options. There's crime. There's child labor. There's child soldiers. There's all those things. They got to choose. Maybe they're going to stay home and help raise the siblings with their parents. Maybe they get lucky, but they're going down that road. And then when it comes time for a kid to actually work and get a legitimate job, they got another problem. Most forthright and legitimate employers require a piece of paper, some sort of piece of paper for that child or that kid or teenager, whatever they are, to hold down a job. So now we've got a section of the population that's uneducated and unemployable. And that's one thing. So if you think about it, if today a million children are born stateless, that's one thing. And okay, we get our heads around that. But now when that million children become 18 years old and no education and cannot get a job, now they've got limited options. So that puts them in a poverty trap that's very difficult to get out of. Because they got it now, they're going to start having kids who are also going to be stateless, and they need to provide for their children. They need to provide for their families. So what options do they have? And it's one thing to talk about how severe that is when they're born. But when you roll the clock up 25 or 30 years later, that's when we get the real epidemic.
Well, isn't it remarkable, too, how something, obviously when you say it, statelessness sounds very ominous and dark, and clearly it is. But I guess what I mean is this one issue, how interconnected it is to pretty much everything else, and something so, in a way, simple. I mean, what do you mean I don't have a birth certificate is my question. I remember going to get a UK passport. My father's from Luton, England, and so I get kind of grandfathered in. I carry two passports. And we went to start. I had to prove who I said I was, and I had to get my parents' marriage certificate. Well, we had a certificate from the church. Or some Anglican church they got married at in Toronto, but we didn't have the marriage certificate from the government, and we couldn't find it, Vaden. And it wasn't just that we couldn't find it in a safety deposit box. There was a period of time where the government was saying, yeah, we don't have a record of that. So my mom and dad, or especially my mom, she's like, well, we are married. It kind of freaked her out a little bit. And so something so simple, right, like that, you see the implications of it, and then you start to say, okay, now I'm starting to see why this is a little more complicated than making something as simple as a black or white or an either or distinction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And the ripple effects of that one little thing are just massive.
Yeah, it's pretty profound. So tell me what, I want to know about the petition that you're asking people to sign. I've heard a bit about you online lately, Vaden. You are becoming a bit more of an activist, and you've got really good reasons for that. So tell us about what's going on and we're gonna kind of wrap up our talk today with a couple of action items for our listeners. But anyway, go ahead. Please bring us into the loop. What's going on?
So back in 2009, I had been doing a lot of humanitarian work in a lot of different countries, but I focused quite a bit of my time between Haiti and Dominican Republic. So met a little girl and her mom at a garbage dump in just outside Puerto Plata in Dominican Republic. And it's pretty common down here that wherever there's a garbage dump, there's a pretty continual supply of plastics that you can recycle, sell to the recycling depot, and make, you know, a few bucks a day for sustenance. So a lot of Haitians that are displaced and have nothing else, they'll go to the garbage dump, they'll collect plastics and make a few bucks. And then there's also, because we're in a tourism area, we find there's a lot of waste of food that gets into the garbage dump system, and they eat that when it shows up at the garbage dump. I know that sounds horrific and disgusting, but that's the world of a lot of people here. So that's where I met this little girl and her mom. And shortly after I met her, the mom passed away. So we were looking at a couple of options, but I said shortly after. It's probably a couple of years, actually. I knew them before the mom had died. And I'd grown quite attached to this little girl. So made some phone calls to our local MP and ended up talking with, at that point, the Minister of Immigration. And we got some help. Or we thought we had help from the government to adopt her. So we went ahead. She had been, when the mom had died, the little girl had been given to the grandmother who couldn't afford to feed her. I mean, she was getting fed 2-3 times a week. And they sent her back to Haiti with another family member because no one could afford to put food in her mouth. And in Haiti, I don't know if you know much about Haitian culture, but there's a system there called the Restavec system. And Restavec is French for stay with. And it's modern day slavery. So I can't say wealthy families will purchase kids from poor families, because it's more like less poor families will purchase kids from more poor families. And they'll buy these kids for 30 or 50 bucks. And then they have them as household servants, and they clean up and they, you know, feed the dog or whatever it is. And these situations are horrific, and it's complete and utter modern day slavery, but it's culturally accepted there. So when this little girl was sent back to Haiti, we all knew that that was going to be in her future as someone in a family that couldn't afford to feed her. So we got the green light from our friends in Ottawa to go ahead and, if we could find her in Haiti, bring her back, and if the grandmother would sign the guardianship documents and all that, then they would push through an adoption. So we did that. And it was looking really good. That was June 15th of 2009 that I had that conversation with my MP, and it was looking really good. And then 6 months later, the earthquake happened. So, and when I say the earthquake happened, I know people that listen to this podcast are probably thinking, well, that's not a big deal because he already got her out of Haiti. But all the paperwork was in Haiti. And if you walk into the office of Child and Family Services in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, you don't see 25 computers and cubicles and all that. You see one rusty desk and one dude sitting there with a Barbie notebook and a pencil.
Right.
That's record keeping. That's what that is. So, and they'll have a file folder with your name on, and everything's handwritten. Even the birth certificates are handwritten. So when the earthquake happened, not only did we lose all records of our approved adoption, we also lost our caseworker. She was killed in the earthquake.
Wow.
So and the whole department was buried. It was just buried. So we started from zero again.
Vaden, what's your daughter's name?
Widleen is my daughter. That's a mouthful. Widleen. WIDLENE.
And how old is she?
Widleen will be 12 this month.
Wow, amazing.
So she was 4 at the time. She's been with us now since then. But a lot of things have changed. Legislation has changed. Haiti stopped approving international adoptions. Canada changed the way they did things. Anyway, it was a lot of stuff. So we kind of thrown in the towel and said, well, I guess it's life in DR until she's 18 and can come to Canada as an adult. We just assumed that was going to be the case.
Right.
But much to our chagrin, about a year ago, Dominican Republic changed their legislation one more time. And what they did was, the UN actually called it a social cleansing. They said that any Haitians, or I shouldn't say Haitians, I should say people of Haitian descent that were living in Dominican Republic had to prove 3 generations of legally immigrated ancestors, or else they would not be given a Dominican identity, which is impossible. Obviously, with the record keeping, like I just told you, nobody can prove that. Certainly, most of them didn't immigrate legally anyways. They came across as refugees. So there's about 750,000 people that have never been to Haiti, but they're Haitian, but they've never been to Haiti. Right. They don't speak Creole. They were born in Dominican. Their parents were born in Dominican. They speak Spanish. They're effectively Dominican. Dominican Republic says, we don't want you. Any of your paperwork is null and void. You can't use it anymore. It's over. So now they're forced, they're started to deport them. Well, Haiti's knee-jerk reaction to the Dominican law was to say, no, you were born in Dominican. You speak Spanish. You don't speak Creole. We don't want you. We're not going to patriate you as Haitian. So in one signing of a pen, that created 750,000 stateless people in this country.
Wow. I mean, talk about interconnected, talk about domino effect, and how one simple decision, and yet, you know, maybe not so simple, affects potentially millions, and the implications go on for generations.
Yeah. And here we are trying to get now the reason that this has gone to a whole new gear, and the reason you're seeing me on the internet and in the news and everything else, is because my daughter, Woodleen, now has joined the population of the most vulnerable people group on Earth as a stateless female under the age of 18. And the chances of potential exploitation in this country are astounding. She's had problems already with police officers. Now that know, they can look at her, they can tell she's Haitian, they assume she has no paperwork to be here, so they're trying to exploit her. And she's like, we've had to deal with some pretty serious situations with law enforcement here. And in one case, just to give you one example, I was sitting down with the chief of police after one of his staff members literally tried to get my 11-year-old daughter to go home with him.
Wow.
And I found out it happened, and we dealt with it as any father would. But I sat down with his boss, and he says, why don't you go down to City Hall and file a formal complaint? And then he smiled. And I said, you damn well know why I can't do that. Because she has no paperwork. And he said, I know. And that smirk on his face made me realize it's really time to leave this country. We it's not a safe place for her anymore.
And so you're asking me, you're asking our listeners, you're asking Canadians, you're asking anybody to get on board and say, to be supportive of you and the family to basically get her. I was going to say, get her back to Canada. But to get her in,
she's never been on a plane.
Right. To get her into Canada. And you know, as you read through your site and bring Woodleen home, by the way, .com, there'll be a link to it on the site and you'll be able to access that there. But Canada has failed us. You're just dead end, Vaden. You've been knocking on doors for quite a few years. Can you give us an overview there?
Yeah, so we've been knocking on doors for quite a few years. Like I said, we threw in a towel until a couple months ago. Things heated up with her being approached, and we just knew it was time. So I put one post on my Facebook, and I said, does anyone know your local MP? And a few people got back to me, and I know my local MP quite well. So we started putting out messages to MPs saying, listen, we need Minister Hussein and Prime Minister Trudeau to get on board with this, because obviously – one of their big campaign things was a more open border and open arms to refugees. And for those that need a helping hand, Canada will be that. And we hear it in every single speech. So I just thought, this is good. We have an opportunity here to utilize that campaign promise. And not just a promise, but what I believe is a philosophy that they've adopted, that we can bring people to Canada that need that fresh start. So we've been pushing. And I was pleasantly surprised with the amount of support we've gotten. There have been days in the last month where Ahmed Hussein, his office, has gotten more than 10,000 emails in a day from our supporters. So it's gotten national TV, it's gotten newspapers, it's gotten all over the radio. But what we're having a problem with is she's not a refugee. She doesn't fit, even like the Syrian refugee, she doesn't
fit.
Right. So she has no paperwork. So they're saying, well, we'll grant you travel documents to come to Canada as soon as you show that you have a fully legalized adoption. But we can't have a legalized adoption without her having a passport in some country that will legalize the adoption. So we're stuck with a situation where the minister does have discretion to offer a temporary residence permit, which just allows her entry into Canada.
Okay.
And he has discretion to issue that. He's been given this file by thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And we're just waiting. And hopefully we're putting some media pressure on him and with the petition and stuff to make that decision. But in the event that they don't, our only option left is to somehow get her to the United States and then drive across the border into Canada like thousands of people have done since January, or walk across, I should say.
Right.
In Manitoba where there's no border crossing, and just claim refugee status, which I can't tell you, there's a mixture of saddening me and enraging me. The fact that me as a Canadian citizen that bore the name of Canada and the philosophy of Canada and taking it to so many countries in the form of a humanitarian aid worker, that I'm going to have to now risk my entire family's life, get on a boat maybe, and then walk across the border as refugees in my own country. There's a problem with that for me. There's a fundamental issue with that.
Oh, yeah, I would think so. I would think there's a problem with that with most of us Canadians, it seems to me. It's crazy to me, Baden. It sounds like to me, you know, hey, no politician over here on this side, but sounds like a pretty simple fix, or at least you'd like to think so. But clearly, fairly nuanced. What's fascinating to me is you've been an activist, you've been an advocate for others most of your life, and clearly people can see that in your writing and the work that you've done. And now it's profoundly personal. It's taking it to a whole new level.
It is. And the problem is, I mean, yes, I'm ticked. I mean, I'm ticked that my life has come to a complete halt just because I've got to do something as simple as keep my daughter safe where she shouldn't have need to need me to do that. So that ticks me off. It ticks me off that it's bleeding us of all of our time, all of our money and everything just to try and lobby the government to do something that seems like it's a given.
Right.
Now, but the bigger problem, I mean, there's a bigger problem here, which is almost unbelievable, is that how many people are represented by the exact same situation that maybe don't have the tenacity or don't have the network that I do to actually get through to the Prime Minister or the Minister of Immigration? How many people quit?
Right.
You know, over the last few years, just said, I can't do it. They said no, and they just throw in the towel. Well, I'm not going to do that. But the problem is, it's they're making me go down a road I don't want to go down, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Right, right. Well, you're clearly fighting back, and you're getting a bigger message out there as well. Very personal, obviously, very connected, which is kind of interesting that we've kind of come full circle, right? Face behind the numbers. Now,
right.
You know, what's the line, this time it's personal? I can't think of what film is that from, but it's a tagline.
Every Arnold Schwarzenegger film ever made.
yeah. So we got to wrap it up, sadly. Vaden, tell me what we can do. I mean, I'm looking at the website here. I can sign a petition. I can contact the media. I can contact my member of parliament. I can share the story. Hashtag, by the way, folks, is enough is enough. What else are you asking people to do?
Well, those things are really important, but right now, as we see it, the biggest strength is still having an MP advocate to the minister for us. And sadly, it's become a partisan thing, so a Liberal MP is more effective than any other MP at this point. But if people that want to help are willing to send an email to their MP, and I've even put on that website, there's even some copy and paste emails to send to your MP.
Right,
I've made it
right.
Very easy. And local media is becoming our strongest suit here. So even people think, oh, I just have a little local newspaper that goes out to 25 houses. That's fine. I'm happy with that. Because anyone in the media getting this is just going to pass it around to their circles, and it will climb up
right
to the top, and it will get there. So MP, local media, the petition is a 30-second step. Just sign your name on the petition. And talk about it. At this point, we've got in the news, we've got the controversy over this Qatar thing and the $10.5 million going to that guy. the guy out in New Brunswick who beat his wife with a hockey stick, or the lady that attacked the guy in the Canadian Tire. There's all kinds of controversial things that seem to boil back to the issue of immigration. This doesn't have to be one of them. This can be one of those feel-good success stories that say, hey, we opened our doors and we're happy we did, because we should have. It was the right thing to do. So talking about it is going to be huge.
I love, as we wrap up here, I love the line on the website, change a life in four simple steps. If that isn't what your life has been about, Vaden, you know, preaching that, you know, it's not as hard as you think that, you know, you can make a difference, and you can, by intervening in this simple way, you can add your voice to the conversation, but more importantly, hopefully towards the solution in this case.
Yeah, exactly. That would be great. I'm happy to see a solution coming.
Vaden, thanks for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. And Vaden Earl joining us from the Dominican Republic. And are you going surfing later today, Vaden? Is that, are you going to be spending your time in another way?
I'm going to spend my time on a outdoor couch with a big old cigar in my hand. That's what I'm going to do today.
There you go. Well, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
New glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.